start speaking? Okay. Good morning, everybody. My name is Wade Jacoby. I teach political science here at Brigham Young University and also direct the Center for the Study of Europe. I do a lot of my work on the European Union and European international organizations over in the political science department. I'm delighted we have this panel here this morning, this breakout session on Central Europe. I think we have a really interesting set of presentations in store for you. We have three presentations this morning, and I'll briefly introduce each of the three speakers now, all together, and then we'll follow in the order indicated on the program without any further ado, and then we'll go to Q&A at that point. Our first speaker this morning will be from Hungary, Tamás Lukács. Mr. Lukács is an active member of parliament. He's in the KDNP party, where he is, his party is allied with the ruling Fidesz party for the last two parliamentary terms. In 1989, he was one of the founders of this KDNP political party, and later its vice president. In 1990, he was elected as a representative of parliament and member of the National Budget Committee and vice president of the Human Rights, Minorities, and Religious Affairs Committee. In 1996, he was one of the chairmen in the presidency of the Hungarian Radio Company, and he was also a lecturer at the Faculty of Law and taught media ethics. He has been a member of parliament now since 2006, first coming in on the electoral list, and then in the last, in the current parliament, winning a direct mandate in the Hungarian parliament. Since May 2010, he has also been president of the National Human Rights, Minorities, Civil and Religious Affairs Committees. Our second speaker from Poland, from Jagiellonian University, will be Henryk Hoffman, who is currently director of the Department of Religious History, the Institute of Religious Studies at Jagiellonian University in Kraków, Poland. He has a long career at this university, and has held various academic positions through the faculty ranks in the Department of History in Jagiellonian University. He is also the editor of the magazine Nomos, the Journal for the Study of Religions, or has been the editor of that journal. And Professor Hoffman will speak second. Our third and concluding speaker will be Lucia Goreškova from the Ministry of Culture in the Slovak Republic in Bratislava. Ms. Goreškova is the Deputy Director of the Department of Church-State Affairs in the Slovak Ministry of Culture, and she has been active in a number of European Union and OSCE organizations concerned with religious affairs in Europe. We're delighted to have each of these speakers with us. The ground rules are, I think, familiar to most of you, but I will say again that we have presentations of about 12 to 15 minutes. There will be simultaneous translation available. That'll be relevant as we go into the question and answer period. We'll ask you to use the microphone. We'll have a roving microphone around the room. And there may be occasional delays as we switch translation languages, but we'll ask you to just bear with us. And we've been practicing this system for many years now, and it works relatively well. So with that, I'd like to turn the time over now to Tamás Lukács.
Thank you for the kind introduction. This means that I'm the one out of this place, because I've been the president of the Human Rights Association until May. I got a new assignment 6 years ago. I was the president of the Independent Police Complaints Board, and only three countries have this in Europe, and we're examining the complaints towards the police, and since I'm the politician here, let me just start with a question. How do you know when a politician is lying? Well, the mouth is moving. And I think we said a lot of things. And I try to keep my time to the 12 minutes, and I don't really stick to the preset text. And my motto that I chose is a quote from Abraham Lincoln from 1964, which states that the will of God prevails in great contest. Each party claims to act in accordance with the will of God. Both may be, and one must be wrong. God cannot be for and against the same thing at the same time. So when I gave the title to my talk, Crisis and or Opportunity, the reason why I started to do my thinking in this direction, because when we think about secularism, it's a culture streamline that is a consequence of some kind of a cultural crisis or the European culture. And it's
when we talk about secularism, first we talked about when people left church positions and moved to secular positions.
So if we're looking at secularism, it's, and if we put secularism into the certain countries' coordinate system, this is how we can properly understand secularization. The second meaning of secularization is as a cultural difference in the Eastern European countries and there were some cultural differences that pertain to, for example, like certain marriage laws. But in today's meaning, secularization is, we kind of look at it from a sociological point of view. But to these questions, I have to note that the sociological meaning of secularization, and to reflect on today's presentation, it's really difficult to have a unanimous definition, because what do we measure? What do we consider secularization? Do we measure it in a state or globally? Or just give one example: if the Catholic Church, according to the Catholic Church statistical data, in European countries, altogether, Catholicism is growing, and since the statistics is about ratios, we should signify that on those areas where the population grows, whether it grows with the demography. So the question is very difficult. The second question is, one of my friends from Austria gave me the 2013 data from Austria, and it's really astonishing that when they say of themselves that they are 74% Catholics, and they're really difficult to compare because they have some kind of a unsubscription from the church. But when they ask the question whether they believe in the afterworld, the age group above 50, only 47% of them say that they believe in the afterworld. So I'm Catholic, but I don't believe in the afterworld. So we really have to be careful about this question to see what the question pertains to. And just to respect to the time, I'd like to get to your attention. We issued this publication in 2014. There was a great discussion between Habermas and Ratzinger. And Habermas also answered some questions from secularization. Habermas says, Jürgen Habermas recognizes that the secular consciousness too pays its price for the privilege of the freedom not to be religious. The essence of the problem, as he sees it, is that for the citizen who is a musical in religious matters, this entails the demand that the identity itself, critically, the relationship between faith and knowledge on the basis of what all the world knows. The worldview neutrally of the state power, which guarantees equal ethical liberties for every citizen, is incompatible with the political generalization of a secularist worldview. Secularized citizens, insofar as they are acting in their role as citizens of a state, should neither deny a truth potential to religious worldviews as a matter of principle, nor dispute the right of believing fellow citizens to make contributions to public discussions in religious language. Yesterday, Senator Hatch's thoughts and that dispute that was in the Supreme Court and also in Hungary, we should reflect to secularization in states and also in churches. And as I was listening to Senator Hatch yesterday, I was thinking about that in questions of religious freedom, whether how we are controlling the legal status of churches. They have these constitutional conditions. When I say that, yes, we have to provide for every person a religious freedom, a freedom of religious practice, and in the same time, if we look at European models, it is really difficult to talk about European models in this chart that I will not go through in details. And when we talk about Europe, we usually talk about Western Europe. However, we should consider the Eastern European development. And if we And if I try to consider this with this icon, that means prayer. The second, like in Samuel Saloniki says, a paint with colors all in conformity with the tradition, painting as ingenuine as the content of the books, it is a work of the divine grace. In the Western Europe Renaissance, the desacralizations, the real great innovation of Renaissance, painting is not in the pursuit of naturalism, but in the scientific rational substantiation of naturalistic presentation. So this is a great theological teaching. The desacralization in the painting means that the Holy Mother is offering her breast for feeding, and that little angel is offering the fruits to the little Jesus that we can follow from the from the Bible. And if we consider these pictures and compare these developments, I just wanted to raise attention to when we talk about Europe, and this is how we're going to understand the Ukrainian situation. We're only able to do this if we don't leave out the development that is in strict connection. And to say, let me get the attention to the 2006 Romanian church law or the Serbian law, where they provide the primatus of the Roman Catholic Church. This, how they recognize the official presence of the Roman and non-Roman churches. And I would like to provide this conference with a gift from the so-called Karpov document. In Hungary, only 10% of the church documents remained to be available. In Moscow, for example, they had about 600 pages of documents pertaining to the Hungarian churches. And this is how I got this document translated. One of the major colonels said that when they extend the Soviet power to Europe, he expounds on how to get rid of each of the churches. And so we look at all these happenings in the history, it just kind of looks like a script book. So it's really interesting, as if we go through these two lines of development, we will be in a common ground throughout history, that we can really understand religious freedom. And the reason why we can do that is because Pope John Paul II says in a poem that freedom is something that you pay a price for with yourself. So we are these nations who paid with ourselves for this freedom. And finally, the state needs to reflect on this situation according to the Habermas thought. And I believe that we should not make legislation, but we have to have jurisdiction. And in answer to our senators, the senator's presentation, the duty of the state is not only to make a law in religion, but also in education law and media law, needs to consider all those citizens who are committed in some kind of a worldview. Just one example from my lens law. In our country, the church schools receive the same amount of money as a support from the government as any other schools, because we say if someone is exercising a freedom of religion and they enroll their children in a church school, they are paying taxes, and we cannot differentiate between taxpaying citizen and, taxpaying citizen. And so they receive equal entitlements. And finally, if we look at secularization, this is a two-pole condition. It's always the between the world and the religious man, the religious individual, and between the world and the religious groups. This is why the religious community needs to react. From a Christian point of view, we see the world as a positive thing, because in the book of creation it says, in every single creation, we read that God said that it was good. And only at the person it says that it's very good, when it created man. And also, we see that we kind of put the world in darkness. And if I look, consider my own religion, the resolution for me is in the final will of Jesus Christ, when he's praying and says, I don't ask you to take them out of the world, but to save them from the evil. If we consider this sentence, then from a religious point of view, this is the answer for secularization.
Hope you feel better.
So this means that we need to recognize our religion, and we're not competitors to each other. We're not enemies, but we have to recognize that we need to learn the culture of discussion and dialogue. And practical atheism is an enemy of religions. It was really easy to take defense with atheism, where we either do something and take the consequences, and it's a lot easier than in this secularized world, in different ways through the media generations, and we're talking about media generations. They kind of diminish the values of these generations, and they don't have any ways of defense. And I apologize that I went off of my original talk, and thank you for your kind attention. And it's really honoring for me that I was invited as a politician to this conference. For me, it's always an intentional decision in my personal life and in my family life. And thank you very much for your attention.
It is commonly known that Roman Catholicism is the dominant religion in the state of Poland. After the Second World War, Poland practically became a country of a single ethnicity and a single religion, with a population of about 38.5 million as of 2012. Poland currently boasts 150 registered churches and religious minorities. Many remain unregistered, yet all claim their constitutional right to freedom of conscience and creed guaranteed to each citizen. The Catholic Church played an important role in forming Polish national identity, especially during the time of partitions between 1795 and 1918, when Poland was divided between the Russian, Prussian, and Austro-Hungarian empires. It was then that the stereotype of Poles being Catholic was solidified. Even though the notion first emerged in the 17th century during the period of anti-Reformation, Orthodox Prussia and Lutheran Prussia often opposed Polish Catholicism, seeing it as a source of protest against the Russification and the Germanization of the Polish society. The circumstances were a bit more favorable under the Austrian-Hungarian partition, where the rulers, the Habsburgs, were Catholic themselves. After World War II, the new communist authorities unanimously affirmed that the Concordat Agreement with the Holy See in Rome from 1925 became invalid because the Catholic Church failed to fulfill its conditions. The new agreement, which is still in force today, was signed in 1993 after the fall of what we call the Real Socialism. We have just celebrated the 20th century of that Concordat Agreement. From the very beginning, its content raised various questions. It is worth mentioning that it was actually not ratified by the Polish Congress until January of 1998 and signed by the Polish President Aleksander Kwaśniewski and then countersigned by the Pope John II in Rome in February of the same year. The official exchange of the document took place on March 25th. The Concordat Agreement was turned into law a month later in April 1998. It was not until after the coalition of the Democratic Left Alliance and the Polish People's Party lost power. The government was then headed by a vast coalition of the rightist parties such as Solidarity, Electoral Action, and Freedom Union. The Concordat Agreement affirmed the legal identity of the Catholic Church and guaranteed it the freedom to fulfill its mission. It was established that the Holy See will inform the Polish government each time it designates new bishops, and it will release new names. Religion will be taught in public schools. The Polish Papal Academy in Krakow and the Polish Catholic University in Lublin will be subsidized, and the cultural heritage of the Catholic Church will be preserved in as much as the circumstances may permit. Educational centers will be established, soldiers will be allowed chaplains, church marriages will be considered legally binding, Catholic religious holidays will be honored, the church will be allowed its own media and broadcasts on the national radio and TV. Similar concordat agreements with the Holy See are currently in force in Hungary, Croatia, Estonia, Lithuania, Slovakia, Latvia, Albania, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Kazakhstan, some of the member states of Germany, Spain, France, Italy, Portugal, Israel, and Brazil. 20 years after the concordat agreement was signed, we are hearing calls for renegotiation of its points, especially by leftist and liberal parties, and in some extreme cases calls for its rejection. Even the Catholic Church sees a need for it to be adjusted to current circumstances, even though it emphasizes that the agreement, unlike the one signed in 1925, does not grant it any real privileges, especially that other denominations and religious organizations draw upon its principles. A prevalent characteristic of modern Polish Catholicism is its national character, including a strong worship of Virgin Mary and a rising worship of John Paul II, Santo Subito. Most Poles consider themselves Catholic, but their faith is generally fairly shallow. A prominent Polish sociologist of religion, Father Władysław Piwowarski, stated in the 1980s that most Poles, about two-thirds of them, are ignorant heretics and do not know the basic principles of their own religion. Based on the results of the latest religious survey called Social Diagnosis 2013, Objective and Subjective Quality of Life in Poland, Professor Janusz Czapiński stated, until 2005, diminishing participation in services and other religious ceremonies was accompanied by an increase in the percentage of people who prayed in difficult situations in life. In other words, Poles went to church less often but prayed increasingly more often. This suggested that deinstitutionalization or privatization of faith and was consistent with the process observed in Western countries, where religious behaviors were becoming more private and institutional forms in the relations between man and God were losing in significance. However, since 2007, the downward trend in institutional religious behaviors was joined by a decline in the frequency of prayer in difficult situations in life, and the decline was even deeper in subsequent waves in 2009 and 2011, or insignificantly only in 2013. This may mean that after a period when faith was becoming more private, the process of Polish society becoming atheistic has begun. An example of secularization processes in Poland is the situation in the 20th century. The previous political factions, such as Christian National Union and then Solidarity Electoral Action, even though their political support was great towards the Catholic Church and the Catholic mass media, after the initial successes, they actually lost the elections, not reaching the required level of 8%. And so despite the fact that the Catholic Church officially declares political neutrality, the practice is quite a bit different, even though its authority is not directly correlated to the political views of the Polish people. The authority of the church is drawn upon by most of the political parties in Poland, which puts the church in a very difficult situation, since many different factions will ask it for its support. The same problem can be seen in the Smolensk catastrophe, where the church was not able to take a clear position as to where the presidential couple should be buried in the necropolis of the royal palace in Wawel in Krakow. The same situation we can see with the situation of the Polish cross which is placed before the presidential palace in Warsaw. Nobody was able to protest the fanatical groups that were overusing the religious symbols in order to fight their own political battle. Since many years in Poland, we can see a very difficult political situations and a discussion to enthrone Jesus Christ as the King of Poland. A project of such a bill is being presented by some of the rightist parties in the Congress as we speak. Such aspirations were reflected in the building in a city of Świebodzin, which is a small city in Lower Silesia in Poland, a gigantic monument to Christ the King, which rivals the one in Rio de Janeiro. From November 2001 to June 2010, that was the biggest statue of Jesus Christ in the world. Subsequently, a bigger one was raised in Lima, Peru, and currently, the local governments of certain Polish cities are trying to raise even bigger statues in their own realm. Another very important element of change which are taking place in Polish Catholicism is the lessening or a decline of calls to the clergy and priesthood. That includes also the convents and monasteries between among both males and females. Also, a lot of people are leaving such institutions, and they lead the clergy state. This trend has surprisingly increased after the death of John Paul II, and in 2006 it raised the percentage of about 25% to 30%. The reasons for that are both objective and subjective. We call it the atmosphere of the anti-calling. In the past, the Catholic Church many times has struggled with similar problems and has developed efficient methods to deal with such issues. What is interesting is that in the newest data, which is not officially confirmed from the 2013, we can see a very solid increase or stable increase of those persons who are willing to join the clergy seminaries in Poland. This could be the first effect or result of what we call the Francis syndrome. It is a very interesting situation which those persons who are leaving the clergy are intellectuals who previously used to be Catholic faculty in some of the universities in Poland. An important problem is also one that reflects the generation of John Paul II and the measure of the Catholic Church in processes of education of the new Polish youth. During the 27 years of the pontificate of John Paul II, a great measure of importance was given to meetings with the youth. And in Poland, the teaching of the religion in elementary schools and also in high school was very important since 1990. However, such programs were taken out of school later. No reason was given for that. We can see that there was a trend of anti-religionism and indoctrination. Instead of that, we were trying to teach ethics lessons in schools, and this practice is not very common. However, most of the youth choose the lessons of religion, which causes a different moral dilemma. It has been about 25 years since religion has been taught in the Polish schools, and so the question is raised: what are the effects of bringing such lessons to religion into the education system, other than being outside of it? Even though those lessons are taught by regular teachers and not always somebody that's clergy educated, they receive regular enumeration and benefits for it. Many of them emphasize the fact that such subjects in school lessons are not meeting the requirements of the church. Participation in lessons of religions is often strictly perceived as formal and not in tact with the youth people, with the young people, and many of the religious duties are actually contradictory to the vision of the church in this particular issue. In conclusion, I'd like to emphasize that in the recent years, the Polish Catholic Church has been subjected to many moral scandals. Partially, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church is seen as trying to bring to media some of the things that are very leftist and attitudes that are liberal for the Catholic Church. We can see that in one of the surveys, which is called the Diagnosis of 2011. We can see that the trust for the Catholic Church is decreasing. According to him, to Mr. Czapiński, the trend in Poland has been very stable, and the results have been slower than in other Catholic countries such as Ireland and Spain. And we can see very solid secularization of the society. It has nothing to do with the media, that the prestige and the worthiness or the trustworthiness of the Catholic Church and its priest is decreasing. It may be simply be credited to the secularization, which is slowing down. It cannot be stopped and it cannot be returned. Thank you very much for your attention.
You mentioned about the research of a number of believers in Slovakia and demonstrated various numbers, gave us the numbers of Catholics, Mormons, etc. What do you think? These kind of surveys, do they violate the freedom of religion? When you are asking about religion, by mere asking, you interfere in personal life of a person. And as far as I understand, not a single country in the world does something similar. I understand that the last time the religion question was asked was in India in 1946, when it was done during the census. Are you sure? You said 994. Are those objective data, or those data is not objective? That is, during the census, don't you violate religious freedom and freedom of conscience? Always people will answer your question truly and objectively or not. What do you think? I would like to explain. In Ukraine, we also have different kind of surveys and ask people about their religion, but we are unable to catch those small groups, for example, Mormons. They somehow fall through the crash from this representative survey that we conduct in Ukraine. For Ukraine, 2,500 responders, if we just ask 2,500, that should be enough. But Baptists, Mormons, and Protestants are not, we do not get data about those. How did you get that number, 942? I was just wondering.
about 10% of the people are given the alternative methods of teaching religion, which is ethics. Now, it has a few different reasons for that. We do not have enough faculty members who are able to teach ethics as opposed to other religious teachings and denominations. It is difficult to support the learning of ethics simply because there are not enough teaching hours provided for a particular teacher. A teacher would have to show up for 1 or 2 hours, and that is just not sufficient. That subject needs to be chosen between religion or ethics, but it is not mandatory. You also do not have to participate in religious lessons or lessons of ethics. And so, because we have very particular data, 90% of youth attends religion classes. From a standpoint of the church, it has its advantages and disadvantages. On one hand, those empty hours or available hours, clergy members would actually like to come in and teach those religious lessons, but this was supposed to be an alternative. If ethics is actually taught by a priest, how is it different than teaching religion? We just wanted to have a different viewpoint, and unfortunately that's not possible to realize. If you're interested in particular numbers, it's about 10% that choose a different religion denomination or the lesson of ethics. However, the Catholic Church is, if I may add, is not very satisfied with this form of teaching religion at schools, because it used to be that it was taught at churches, and a student would have to go to church. It was a way of celebration, a way of a holiday almost, something that was sacred. Right now, it's basically a lesson. It's a class that they attend, and oftentimes students consider this class attendance as something that they just need to check off on a list, other than actually participating in the religion. We consider that since we attend religion classes at school, he is somehow excused from attending church, and that is a very big issue for the church, because that was not their design. I also wanted to add an additional fact, where most people that choose a subject different than religion go to private schools. From what I'm understanding, about 80% of those who can attend ethics classes are in private schools, and then ethics is basically the only subject being taught. Religion is actually not being taught at all. And so it causes a dilemma for students attending public schools and social schools. They have to attend religion classes, whether they like it or not.